So last week, when we heard the passage where Jesus says to the disciples, "Who do you say that I am? Who do the crowds say that I am? You are the Christ of God." And then Jesus says that the Son of He will suffer many things, be rejected by the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, and then be killed, and then 3 days afterwards He will be raised. And He also warns His disciples that anyone who follows Him must take up their cross daily and follow Him. Now, Jesus does keep this secret, but then in a sense, He kind of blows the secret today when He continues His mission and He sets His eyes straight to Jerusalem. Now, the way that Luke writes this when he's writing this particular gospel, what he's stating fairly plainly is that Jesus is now has his eyes set on his own death. He's going to Jerusalem because he knows that it's in Jerusalem that he will die and rise again. And he has, in a sense, an ironclad will. This is where I'm going to go, and nothing is going to stand in my way. This is the will of my Father, and therefore this is my will. And so one of the interesting things about it is that it often perplexes the people around him, and they don't quite understand what he's about. And most notably, this village of Samaritans. Now, we often know, if you come to Mass regularly enough or you read the scriptures, it explains that Jews and Samaritans don't get along. In John's Gospel, it says pretty plainly that Jews and Samaritans don't share anything with each other. And the story of the parable of the Good Samaritan, Jesus uses a Samaritan to shock his Jewish listeners to realize that sometimes goodness can come in the most unexpected places, and sometimes the people you think most contemptible. But the reason why the Jewish people and the Samaritans don't get along is actually because they're family. It's classic. The Samaritan people are, in fact, a part of the Hebrew people. They're not Jewish, but they're a part of the Hebrew people. So the Hebrews are a certain ethnicity of people among whom the people of Israel come. The people of Israel are the 12 tribes of Jacob's sons. Jacob has 12 sons, and then those 12 tribes make up the people of Israel. But then eventually, all of these different tribes, they've had their difficulties, and that's also symbolized in the story of Joseph, not Joseph, the father of Jesus, or the foster father of Jesus, but Joseph, one of the sons of Jacob, because they don't like him very much, and they think he's some kind of pseudo-mystic, they throw him in a hole and leave him for dead. And then eventually he becomes an Egyptian prime minister, if you want to call it that. There's no such thing as an Egyptian prime minister in the scriptures, but this is a kind of a paraphrase. And then he comes back. Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. That's the whole story. But these 12 tribes, they often have these internal difficulties. And then King David, when he starts his kingdom, when he unifies all of the tribes in one kingdom, he's a really smart, clever guy. There has to be at least one David who's smart, because there's... No. So he's really smart, he's really clever, and he realizes that because these tribes are so different among themselves, that if he were to just put the kingdom in his hometown of Bethlehem, then all of the other tribes are not going to like him, because he's from the tribe of Judah. So the last thing that he wants to do is to have everybody say, "You like Bethlehem because that's where you're from." So what David does is he goes out from his home, he takes the city, Jerusalem, and makes it the center not only of his kingdom, but also of the temple. Up until then, most of the Hebrew people had worshipped in Mount Gerizim, G-E-R-I-Z-I-M, or Z-I-M, depending on your 49th parallel positioning. So he establishes Israel's worship and kingship in this one city. And there are some people that don't like it. Most notably, the Samaritans. They think that this movement to Jerusalem is, in fact, an abomination unto the Lord. That it's some kind of heresy, some kind of ridiculousness. And so they break off. They do their own thing. And the people of Israel have their continual breaks that go throughout history. And then this break goes on for centuries after the fact until the time of Christ. At this point now, they're pretty much irreconcilable. In fact, there are still Samaritan villages today in parts of the Middle East that still see themselves as Hebrew people who worship the one God, but they think Jerusalem is a hoax. So, Jesus sets his sights towards Jerusalem, and they're thinking, more of the same old thing. And they just discard him out of court. Because initially the disciples are meant to be able to go in advance and say, hey, Jesus is coming. Bring your questions. Bring your sick. Bring your problems. The guy is on his way. And they say, if he's interested in Jerusalem, we ain't interested at all. And of course, you have the disciples, you would think, oh, they've rejected Jesus. What a bunch of horrible people. And they want... James and John are funny guys. The scriptures call them Boergenes, the sons of thunder, because they have a slightly thunderous temper. And so they show this temper by saying, you know, should we send fire and brimstone from the sky? You know, like some kind of zealous preacher of a certain sort. And Jesus just turns around, like the scriptures are pretty clear. Jesus just turns back and says, shut up, and keeps on going. And you might get this kind of impression that Jesus is not at all interested in the toughness. But it's where he directs it that is the interesting question. Because although he shows mercy to these Samaritans, he shows mercy to them because he knows they don't reject him because of who he is. They reject him because of his culture. They reject him because of his ethnicity. They reject him because of where he worships. But he knows that it's not a real rejection. But then when his disciples eventually start saying to him, I will follow you, that's when Jesus starts showing his teeth. Lord, I will follow you. But wait, let me bury my father first. Let the dead bury their own dead. It's like, wow. That first merciful, tender guy all of a sudden turns clean round, and you wonder, where on earth does this intensity come from? No one who puts a hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. You kind of wonder, like, where does this guy get this from? But here's the trick. Sometimes we can be, let's just say, welcoming and nice, but in slightly superficial terms, or only because we share a certain affinity with somebody. One of the reasons that our culture is having a harder and harder time keeping ourselves together is because our bonds don't go to the depths of who we are and to a nature of a choice. And this choice must be for all. These disciples, good as they may be, in the end, they still see the world in the realm of us and them. We have our culture, we have our ethnicity, and you're those people. And it's really easy for us to identify with people with whom have a similar language, culture, background, and all of these different things. And then we can be immediately quick to assume that those who share our background are our friends, and that those who do not happen to be our enemies. But this is not the basis upon which Christianity stands, because the gospel that Christ proclaims is for all people. All people. Jew, Gentile, male, female, slave, or free, as Paul said last week. And because it has this universal thrust, it is in fact very difficult to go out of that comfort zone and to be able to start proclaiming a gospel to someone whom we know is different than ourselves. We have to start understanding the world, not the way we would like to see it, but the way that they see it. Not the way we think the world should be, but understanding better and more with greater clarity and tenderness that they, in fact, are not nuts. They're just different. And that takes tremendous spiritual courage. And it also takes tremendous discipline. Because if one wants to look at the other part of today's second reading, Paul says, "For freedom Christ has set us free." At the very basis of the people of Israel's experience of faith is that they are a poor people that God sets free from an oppressor. But one of the most interesting nuances of history is that if you want to find a tyrant, they often think themselves a freedom fighter. If you want to find a person who will cause untold moral, social, sexual, whatever destruction, they'll often think themselves that they are in fact fighting to either repair the damage that has been done to them or to somehow prevent other people from harming them. And to tell them to back off, to tell them to slow down, to tell them and warn them that it's not going to be so simple, it sounds to them like a social or racial or sexual betrayal. And the only way in which we can overcome this is by really understanding what Jesus says to his disciples today. Sometimes you have to leave your family behind, because God is more important. Sometimes you have to leave the party behind, because God is more important. Sometimes you have to leave friends, your spouse, whatever behind, not like behind, but of a different mindset than them, because God is more important. Now, somebody might be thinking, and I think that rightly so, that so many people have done that with religion in the past and have caused many, many tragic difficulties. And I would agree with you, except there's the problem. They followed religion more than they followed God. And here comes one of the great divides that we truly need to understand. That what God truly wants of us is worship of Him in spirit and in truth. That we know that God addresses us on this personal level, and therefore to follow His will is always the best. Because if He lays down His life for me, then I should and must lay down my life for others. Even if it means I might offend somebody. Even if it means somebody might hate me. Even if it means the church might become unpopular. Because what happened, for instance, in that horrible thing that happened in Boston, in Newfoundland, or in many other places around the world, where the church would hide and protect itself and doing evil? Were they more interested in God or the world? And I think when we meditate on that question, we know exactly what the answer was. Did we want to honor God in truth, or did we want to look good? The same thing happens in the world of money. The same thing happens in the world of family. Speak the truth, do the truth, and know it's not going to be easy. But this is the real and great and glorious payoff. The freedom that God gives is something that transcends this world. The grace that God will supply us with in order to, in fact, proclaim Him and to follow Him in truth will reveal to us that it is better to be His disciple than to have all these things. For the freedom that the world seeks is based on, if I have money, I can self-determine. If I have land, I can self-determine. If I have my ability to do my own thing and to live my own way, then I'm in control of my life. But of course, if I have land, it means that I've excluded so many others. But there is only one person in the history of the universe that will be you. And that is a limitless treasure trove of grace and joy. Our culture keeps wondering how on earth we can get ourselves out of the holes of the lies, the cheats, the corruptions, and all the different things that have plagued our society. Maybe we should do the simple and honest and obvious thing. Proclaim the truth. Live the truth in humility and in joy. And I guarantee you, because it's happened many times before, our society will see life. But I encourage you, don't do this because society needs it. Live the truth because it's so much more interesting. It's so much more fun. You get the joke of life. You get the fun of life. And more, you get to taste the sweetness of her wine.